afternoon session of today. Again, Raphael Sorkin needs no introduction, but I'm very happy to do an introduction for him. Raphael Sorkin is at the Perry Mason Institute as a senior research affiliate, and he's emeritus professor at Syracuse University. He did his PhD in Caltech on symplectic methods for gravity and electromagnetism. He did postdocs in Cardiff, University of Chicago, IIS Princeton, and Maryland before joining Syracuse University. In 1987, which is a year after, around the same time in Syracuse, just historically it's kind of an interesting time, he co-founded the causal set approach to quantum gravity, which subsequently led to a prediction of the fluctuation in lambda, which is exactly what was seen later, perhaps almost a decade later. He's also made significant contributions to several branches of physics and mathematics, notably the notion of entanglement entropy, finding spin half from gravity, the Kaluza-Klein monopole, contributions to Regi calculus, among many others.
Thanks, Samantha. Is this good? Is the mic working?
Yes.
Okay. So thanks everyone for coming, and thanks to the Troika for inviting me, I could say. And as you'll see in a second, here's the title of my talk, in case you didn't see it before. I'm trying a new method. My talks have the habit of always lasting too long, and all the important stuff is rushed at the end. So this time, I've written everything out, which I think is going to pace everything better. Let's see how it goes anyway. If it really goes, if I don't put in too many things or aren't too many questions, we should actually finish early. Never say that. Dangerous statement. So today I want to go out on a limb. Is the cursor is visible here, right?
Yeah.
So today, I want to go out on a limb and tell you about an idea that's actually only a few days old, but it has the potential to answer a long-standing question in causal set theory, the question of how to find a quantum mechanical dynamics, which generalizes the well-established classical sequential growth models for causal sets, which are classical but stochastic dynamics of some standing. Just as general relativity, the Einstein equations, flow naturally from general covariance on one hand and locality on the other hand, these CSG models, classical sequential growth models, flow from two basic principles, which we call discrete general covariance, also label invariance, a discrete analog of general covariance or diffeomorphism invariance, and Bell causality. In GR, there's locality. In causal sets, it turns out that there's no well-defined notion of locality, and so you can't use it as an input principle analogous to locality in GR. Instead, there's a causality condition which we call Bell causality. And the main goal of this talk is to get to a different causality condition that would work in the quantum case. So the former principle, that of label invariance, generalizes naturally to the quantum case, but Bell causality does not. And it has been a long-standing problem in causal set theory to find some other causality condition to act in the place of Bell causality, or either to generalize it, to either generalize it or to find some other. So far, we still don't know how to generalize it. But I will propose that a certain principle, which I will call persistence of zero, or POZ for short, will be what could be what we are looking for. Or I'll propose that it will be what we are looking for. Persistence of zero is formulated in the framework of quantum measure theory. And so it's not in terms of operators, it's not like algebraic quantum field theory, it's in a somewhat different framework, which is basically which is basically a path integral. Quantum measure theory, as I said here in turn, is a simple generalization of the path integral framework. So in order to describe what persistence of zero means, I'll have to first say something about what is quantum measure theory. So my talk will be in three parts. First, introducing quantum measure theory. Second, the condition of persistence of zero. And finally, the proposal for what persistence of zero could mean in application to causal sets. So first, quantum measure theory. This is also dangerous to do, but I should encourage questions along the way since I still feel that there's going to be a little time to spare. So there are different ways to think about what quantum measure theory is, different routes into quantum measure theory. But today I want to try to present it in a way that will allow the condition of persistence of zero to be defined most simply. The basic concept we need for this purpose, the basic concepts are always for quantum measure theory, are these two, the concept of an event and the concept of the quantum measure of an event, which generalizes a classical probability in a probabilistic or stochastic classical theory. So first, what is an event? E, let's call it E. An event is something that can happen, not that it necessarily had to happen or will happen, but it's something that potentially could happen. So if you were to give a list of all the events in a theory, you would have all the possible things that could happen in that theory. Now, what an event means concretely depends on the theory that one is considering. For example, the simplest example in a single, where are my pictures? What did I do? Is my knapsack here somewhere? Yeah, okay. So, in case I don't remember the full picture. So the simplest thing, I was going to draw these in advance, but we had some problems setting the computer up. So consider a very simple theory, which is just a theory of a particle, a single particle. And consider, this is space-time, consider a region R in space-time. Then the event E could be the event that the particle encounters at some point in its history, it goes through R. In other words, its world line meets R. So here's the particle world line, one possible world line, I'll call it gamma one. Here's another possible world line, gamma two, and here's another possible world line, gamma three. These gamma one and gamma two obviously do meet the region R, and so they therefore belong to the event E. Let's call it E sub R. The third world line does not, and therefore it's not in the event D. So I could say gamma one and two is in, and gamma three is not in the event E. Okay. Now what I wanted to do. Interesting. Either fell out. Well, I think I remember what the diagrams are supposed to be, but funny that it's not here. Oh, here it is. Yeah. Okay. Fell out. Okay, so that's what an event means for that particular theory. Take another theory like cosmology. In cosmology, there could be an event E that the cosmos will expand to 100 gigaparsecs, and after 30 billion years start to contract and recontract down to a singularity. That's another event. Yes?
Sounds much more like a sequence of events.
Yeah, oh yeah, thanks for mentioning. So one thing it's related to what you're saying. An event does not mean anything like a point of space-time. A point of space-time you might view as a special case of an event, a birth of a causal set element or something, but I mean event in the more a broader sense that is used in everyday language, which is the terminology has been adapted from stochastic processes or probability theories, where they have what they call a sample space and an event is a subset of the sample space. Here we have a history space and an event corresponds to a set of histories, as I'll say in a second. So an event is not localized in time or space necessarily.
Linguistically, an event would be something that's localized, you know, so that's a weird way.
Well, it's never that localized. I mean, take an event like a birthday party or something. I mean, this conference. Yeah, this conference is an event. This is a real event, this conference. And it extends over.
But in the context of my life, it is essentially.
But all our histories go through this.
Well, yeah.
We're not in this conference.
So if we have a cyclic universe with a huge number of bounces, then this is localized.
Marina.
So in this case, what you're defining by event, I think, is a bit different from your usual causal set. And this is not a quantity of nature, right? It requires a scientist to come and say, I will call event.
No, I don't mean it has to be an observed. You mean we get to define the event? Yeah, absolutely. We
determines what are the events. They don't exist in nature before.
They don't all happen, right? But there is this, if you like, the algebra, which is a Boolean algebra of all events, and that's part of the kinematic framework of the theory. But you're right, nature doesn't necessarily, I mean, it's up to nature to tell us which events actually happen and which don't happen. And that's the ones which happened are some small subset.
You are asking the question before in a probabilistic statement. Is that what you're doing?
Well, so it'll be quantum probability, but yes. Right. So in a theory of causal set growth, an event E could be the event that someday an element will be born, such that every other, and we'll see that the dynamics for causal sets a kind of birth process. It could be the event that someday an element will be born, such that every other event either is its ancestor or will be its descendant. Such an element is called a post, and it is the causal set counterpart of a cosmic bounce that I was just talking about, or if the cosmos were to bounce after contracting. Or it could be something much simpler, like the event that the first five elements of the causal set, when they are born, form a chain. We'll come back to an example of something like that a little bit later.
Okay.
Finally, yeah.
Could you give an example of what is not an event?
What is not an event? Let's see, the quantum measure is not an event. Or the measure of an event is not an event.
This is asking what kinds of subsets of histories would you call
events? Is that what you're asking?
Events, and what would you not call events?
The definition I have, the intuitive definition, is that it's something that can happen or cannot happen, but with respect to the given theory. But in a second, I'll say you may like better that, I'm almost there. I'll say that an event can be regarded as a set of histories, identified with a set of histories. Then, of course, you may ask, what's a history? So we can keep going like this. But in this example that I gave, a history, it would be a world line of the particle. If we were doing cosmology, a history would be a complete specification of the space-time metric for all time and all the other fields that may be there, and so on. That a history is what's summed over in the so-called sum over histories.
I can just give the technical definition, which is it's a set of measurable, it's all the measurable sets in that sample space. You can put a measure on it. It's an
Well, let me give the, oh yeah, come on.
You say that the quantum measurement.
Measure, not measurement. Measure.
It's not an event, but the example, you mean maybe I understood, the fact that if you have a quantum detector that clicks.
That will be an event.
That's a quantum.
The clicking is the event. But the probability of the clicking is not an event. It's just a real number that we attach classically to the event, or even quantum mechanically to a detector. Maybe that was a bad example. Let's.
I think it's the quantum measure, but quantum measurement.
It happens or it doesn't happen with some probability as kind of.
Well, I didn't say with some probability. Event is something which either happens or doesn't happen. But I'm not yet using probability.
So the photon detector click or doesn't click.
Exactly. Right.
Measure is different from measurement.
Maybe in French they're the same, actually. I think, is it just measure in both cases? Yeah. So I think there might. Maybe I should have called it something else.
It depends on language, whether something is an event.
Yeah, that's right. An event in Paris is not the same as an event in Waterloo. Anyway, so let me give the final example. We've already heard the final example. It might be a photon detector. If you're interested in a laboratory instrument, then there are events such as the clicking or the remaining silent of the detector, which Francois mentioned. Okay. So it is clear, I think, that an event can happen in many ways. Look at the ways, two ways that the event could happen there. Each of these ways is one of the histories, which is now getting to your question, that's referred to in the phrase sum over histories. Thus, we can identify an event with some subset of the space omega, it's usually called, which consists of all conceivable histories. So that's the history space of the theory. In probability language, it's the sample space of the theory. But history is a better word because it gets the temporal aspect, and it's the physicist's term. So in our first example, the set E, the event E, would be the set of world lines, the subset of all world lines that do meet the region R. So as I wrote there, E1 and E2 would belong to the event construed as a set of histories, and E3 would not. But there are many more histories in the event E and many more outside the event E. Now, so that's the idea of event. So now given, but there's something more, they form a Boolean algebra. Given two events, let's call them A and B, we can define the event A and B, which, classically speaking, is an event which happens if and only if both A and B happen. If we think of what that means in terms of subsets of omega, the event A and B is more precisely just the intersection of A and B. So like if you had a second region here, and you had the event sort of R prime, some other region, and you had the event E prime corresponding to meeting that, then, you know, a world line could meet R and not R prime, or it could meet R prime and not R. If it meets both, then the event R and R prime happens. So the logical term and is just set theoretically intersection. Sometimes people distinguish this as the, if I can get the words right, intentional description, and this is the extensional description for anyone who's ever heard those terms. So far, time has played no role in the story, in what I've been saying so far, but when we come to persistence of zero, the combination time will be crucial, and the combination A and then B will be important. When we write that down, what we mean is that B is temporally later than A, and in a way that is obvious when you have a background causal structure, that is not at all obvious when you have a dynamical causal structure. And that's part of the difficulty in defining causality conditions in any quantum gravity theory. So that's event and the connective and then, which will be the centerpiece of the story at some when we get there. The second concept we need is that of measure. This is not measurement. This is just like probability measure. It's just a number, we'll see, not always a number. It generalizes the classical concept of probability measure of an event, which is a number, a positive real number between 0 and 1. But actually, a given event, E, can be associated with two different measures, one of which can be derived from the other. The first measure is a measure in the usual sense, meaning that it's an additive set function. It's additive on the disjoint events it adds. The only difference is that it's not valued in the real numbers, it's valued in a Hilbert space. So the measure of an event in the first sense is a vector in a Hilbert space. I'll write it, it's convenient to write it in this way, using this Dirac-like notation, as the ket E. Don't ask. Some of you has a lot to know, knows a lot about. Well, go on, answer it.
Right. So it depends. So when you define it, for example, in the sequential growth, you will define it as a finitely additive quantity. And then, of course, the question is, because we want to ask covariant questions, whether it will extend or not. And that's something.
Yeah, that's a.
Okay. That is an open question.
Okay.
If one looks at it in even quite simple quantum theories, it's allowing time to run to infinity, you find that it cannot be extended to the full sigma algebra generated by the events you started with. So there's a real difference from classical probability theories. But it seems that it can be extended to enough for physical purposes. So one is lurking there maybe as a generalization of the whole Kolmogorov extension theorem,
yes,
and so on. Okay. Which is, something Sumati has worked on a lot. So we have this vector measure, which is finitely additive. The second measure of an event E is, I'll use mu of E suggesting that mu is some generalization of the probability measure, classical measure, and it's just the square of the Hilbert space vector E. It, unlike the vector itself, it is a positive real number, but unlike the vector, it is not additive, not even finitely additive. Instead, it satisfies a certain three-slit sum rule that expresses the absence of higher order interference in quantum mechanics. When E is an instrument event, in a special case, when E is an instrument event, this mu of E has an immediate interpretation as the probability that the event actually happens. For example, the probability that the detector clicks, you have to, of course, to compute that, of course, you have to include the detector in your system, and then you can compute, or it's widely believed, let's say, that if you could do the full computation with the detector, its measure would be the probability of a click. This makes it clear that the formula, this formula here, that mu of E is the square of E, is just an expression of the Born rule. So now we have event and measure of an event. I haven't told you really, I've tried to tell you in sufficient detail what an event is, but I've left measure of event kind of vague. So let me illustrate how the event would be defined, how the measure, the vector measure of an event, would be defined in ordinary quantum mechanics in the special case of a unitarily evolving closed system with an initial pure state given by the vector psi naught. the measure is actually more general, but in that special case, the measure of the event E, remember the event E is can be identified with a set of histories. The measure of the event E is some operator I called U, although that's not a good, it suggests unitary and it's not in general unitary. I should have given it another name, I suppose. A, another A. Anyway, X. Yeah, anyway, U, so, but U sub E of psi naught, where U sub E is an evolution operator computed by a pass integral in precisely the usual way, except that in doing the pass integral, you restrict the sum over the histories gamma to those histories that belong to the event E. Okay? Otherwise, it's the usual formula. I've left out here the contribution to the amplitude of the initial wave function. I've absorbed it into S. But if you wanted to write it more fully, you would include that psi naught of the initial endpoint of the history. Okay. Thus, the vector measure in this case belongs to the usual Hilbert space of the theory. More generally, though, for example, if the unitary, if the evolution was non-unitary, or if the initial density matrix, if the initial state was a density matrix, a mixed state, then E will lie in some other Hilbert space.
But in general, are you assuming there's a measure of the space of events?
Not a, well, yes, I'm assuming, I mean, that's what we're trying to define, this vector measure. And I'm just.
Gap.
Oh, the space of histories.
Space of histories.
A background, an integration measure?
Yeah.
I don't want to say yes or no. It depends on the particular theory. In the case of causal sets, we'll just have a counting measure as background measure. But in general, I mean, that's the whole issue, even non-relativistic quantum mechanics. How exactly do you define the path integral? Is there an integration measure and then an amplitude? Or just the product is meaningful? So I don't want to get into those technical questions because they're not, fortunately, too relevant to causal sets. So now we have the ingredients that we need to define persistence of zero. So consider the setup. Now we have another picture set up here where we have a source. Oops. We have a source that emits some sort of particle. Let's suppose just say it was a neutron. We have a series of slits, I'll call them. They could be beam splitters or who knows what. And I'm going to label these slits A1. I don't know if everyone can see this. A1, A2, B, C, and D. And now a particular trajectory might be this one, say. Now consider the, let A, oh, when I write A1, I mean the event that the particle passes through that slit. When I write B, I mean the event that the particle passes through B, and so on. Then the event A1 and B is the event that it passes through both of those slits, which the one that I drew there actually did. However, for us, the interesting case in defining persistence of zero is the case where B lies in a dark band of the diffraction pattern so that its measure is zero. We have then, we get a very small deduction, that the measure of B is zero, but remember that was just the square of B. Well, if the square of B is zero, then the vector B itself is zero because we're in a Hilbert space.
So just coming back to this picture, so is this the situation where your measure of B would be zero? Is that?
This situation is general, but let us now assume that the measure of B is zero.
Okay.
Yeah, this was, I don't want to always assume that the measure, but the one that's of interest for defining, for illustrating the meaning of persistence of zero is that the measure of B is zero. Now, of course, just because the measure of B is zero, that doesn't mean that the measure of the event B and A1 is zero, right? That's the most familiar thing about two-slit experiments. This event could have a non-zero amplitude. This trajectory could have a non-zero amplitude. The reason that the measure of B is zero is, of course, that there's another event, another history or set of histories. This is supposed to originate from the source, by the way. there's another one, and its amplitude precisely, whatever it does now, its amplitude precisely cancels the first set of histories. So just because B is there, it doesn't follow that some other B and A for some other event also has measure zero, precisely because of interference. What does follow is that the sum, in this case, that the sum of the two events measures B and A1 and plus B and A2, that which is just the event or the measure of the event B itself, that is zero by assumption. On the other hand, and this is the key thing, if mu of B is zero, it does imply that mu of B and D is zero. Because after all, if the particle cannot make it through the slit B, how can it proceed to D? So what's the difference between these two cases? Evidently, the difference is that A and A1 and A2 are earlier than B, these events, whereas C and D are later. So we can say this another way. Classically, let's go back to classical probability theory. If the measure of an event is zero, and B is any other event, then the measure of the event A and B is also zero, no matter what B may be, because any subset of a set of measure zero is also a set of measure zero in classical measure theory. Quantum mechanically, this is not true in general because of interference, as we just saw. Nevertheless, it is true in standard quantum theories if B is later than A, so that the combination A and B can be written as A and then B. So in other words, we have this implication. If the measure, if mu of A is zero, then mu of A and then B is also zero for any event B which is later than A, or in fact space-like, but not earlier than A.
So now your notion of later and earlier, because previously emphasized you did not have.
That's right, that's right. Exactly. So now we will need, in order to make sense of this, we will need a notion of later and earlier.
What is time order? Is it the history? Is it what is?
Well, let's look.
So you're going back and forth between event and history, and I got a little bit confused about it.
The events have a time order. So if you'd like to think in terms of algebraic quantum field theory, the event would be associated, an event would be associated with a region of space-time. And it's the regions that are ordered. In the case of the dynamical causal structure, it's very obscure what exactly means later and earlier. And what I'm going to end with is a proposal how to give it meaning for the causal set.
Just to give you roughly 10 minutes.
Oh, okay. I was afraid that would. So the event is a special case of persistence of zero, but it's not the full condition. So let me state the full condition here. I'll try to rush through it a little bit because the basic idea is already there. But you need to define the full condition, you need to say a little more. What we just saw was that if mu of A was zero, then mu of A and then B is zero. But remember, if mu of A is zero, then it means the vector measure A itself is also zero, because mu is just the square of the vector. So we could write it this way: if the mu of A is, if A ket is zero, then so is A and then B ket. This tells us that if a certain vector vanishes, then so also do various other vectors. Now here's another vector that vanishes, just some linear combination of some vectors ket A sub j with coefficients lambda sub j. Persistence of zero is just a generalization of this equation to the, where the left-hand side is generalized to this, that some linear combination vanishes. Persistence of zero requires also that in that case, the corresponding linear combination with the same coefficients of the events A, J, and then B also vanishes. There was a remark here about the decoherence functional and how to express that condition in terms of the decoherence functional. For those who are interested, know about decoherence functionals, you can take a look at this. I'm just pointing out that you don't need to introduce the vector measure, because people often talk just in terms of the decoherence functional and not the projection, not the vector measure. Okay, so we have the basic idea of resistance of zero. We have the full-fledged condition, and now we want to ask, the main thing is they depend on having a temporal ordering of events. And now we want to ask, what does it mean for a growing causal set? So I have to say, as I said earlier, we're seeking a replacement for Bell causality. I didn't actually define Bell causality, but as its name suggests, it's an analog of Bell's condition of local causality. And it's an analog which continues to be meaningful even though the causal structure is now dynamical. And this is remarkable in a sense, even though the dynamics is stochastic, so you don't have a fixed background structure, GR manages to give meaning to causality in the context of a dynamical causal structure, but it's deterministic. But even if it's stochastic, makes it harder, but nevertheless, Bell causality is such a definition. From that condition, together with the covariance condition of label invariance, one can derive a family of classically stochastic growth laws known as classical sequential growth. Some of these models have interesting properties, which I won't draw on again for lack of time. Some of them produce kind of cartoon versions of cosmology that have many features in common with real cosmology and show the way how quantum gravity might produce without any intervention of inflation or anything like that, initial conditions of the sort that we actually see in our cosmos. Let me just go a little quickly. Now, the question is, if we could generalize Bell causality to the quantum case, then we would have the way forward to generalize classical sequential growth models. However, we have not ever found a way to do that. So the question now is whether persistence of zero, a slightly different causality condition, can offer what we need to supplement label invariance and lead to a more realistic causal set dynamics of what you might call QSG, quantum sequential growth. But what you might ask, why is persistence of zero a causality condition at all? Part of the answer is that it is what I've shown, but it's not the whole answer. But what we saw is that conditioning on an event A can upset the vanishing of mu of B. For example, if you condition on A1, then mu of B conditioned on that will no longer vanish when B is later than A, but vice versa, not when B is earlier than A. In this sense, we might say the past is affecting the future, but not vice versa, and that matches the most primitive meaning of causality. There's actually much more to the story, but no time to explain it here. What it suggests is that persistence of zero corresponds to a condition that one might call separable causality, lying somewhere between local causality on one hand and just plain relativistic causality on the other hand. But let's get back to causal sets and their growth. And to carry persistence of zero over to this setting will be straightforward if we can figure out what it means for one causal set. We can answer Abai's question in the case causal set. What does it mean for one causal set event to be earlier or later than another causal set event? To see why this might be difficult, consider this succession of theories. In quantum field theory, we had a causal structure fixed in advance. You can say all kinds of things like space-like commutativity. We immediately know what that means. In classical sequential growth, or for that matter, in classical GR, the causal structure is dynamical, but it's still definite. When it's all over, there's one single space-time or one single causal set with one set of causal relations. And that gives you a purchase. Yeah?
Okay. The dynamics you are defining are explicitly time asymmetric, right? The quantum dynamics.
The quantum measure, yes, it will be explicitly time asymmetric.
The quantum theory that will result breaks time symmetry.
It will, that's right. And so it's an that raises a whole bunch of questions. But let me, there's less than 5 minutes. And then finally, there's quantum sequential bubbles, which we're hoping for, or quantum gravity. For that, the causal structure is not only dynamical, it's indefinite. By indefinite, I mean you're dealing with something like many histories, many spacetimes, many causal sets. If you like the word superposition, it's a quote-unquote superposition of causal structures. Every theory of quantum gravity, I think, faces this problem, with the exception of those theories which don't actually quantize gravity, but are still quantum gravity theories in the sense that they, you know, have the right limits of GR, classical GR. But now, the rest of the talk is to show you an idea of how to give an ordering to events in the case of quantum sequential growth of causal sets, and therefore we can define, if we give that ordering, that gives us a meaning to and then, and therefore we can define, there's no more, it's just one slide. So that gives a meaning to and then, and therefore to persistence of zero. So let's look at the growth of a causal set. What do I mean by saying that the dynamics for a causal set is a growth process? So you start, say, with nothing. An element is born. Then another element is born, maybe to the future of the first element. Then another element is born, also to the future of the first. Another element is born to the future. It has of three, but not of two. It has three as a parent, as one might say. Then another element is born, and so on, who has four as a parent and has one, three and four as ancestors. And then finally an element six is born, which has parents as two and four and ancestors of all these except five. It's set, and then you go on in that way. That's a birth process, and that's the process. It's the Markov version of this process with classical probabilities that defines classical sequential growth models. Now we can now identify two possible events with respect to this process. I'll indicate them this way. It should be two. This A is the event. It should be written up there also, I hope. A is the event that the first three elements form either a V or a lambda. And then by B, I mean the event that elements four and five form a two chain, which in fact they do here. And in fact, both in this, if this, with respect to this history, both of the events happen. So this history belongs, it turns out, to both the events, A and B, just by chance. So the important thing is that the event A asks something about what elements one through three are doing, and event B asks something about what elements four and five are doing. And in that sense, if we use this label, this birth order as a kind of time, then event B is later than event A, and therefore the combination A and then B makes sense. It's meaningful, and it can occur in a persistence of zero equation. And in fact, when you look into the way that Bell causality is defined, it uses exactly that notion of a kind of time. One must be very careful that time has aspects of gauge. It must not conflict with general covariance. For example, in that picture there, if I were to swap the labels two and three and say that element three was born before element two, that should change nothing physical. And you have to be careful to do that, but that's what one does to define CSG, and one could do the same thing for quantum sequential growth. There's a possible worry here, which I'll skip, technical, since I think I'm basically out of time, and I'll just finish by just underlying that this is the key idea, that if we use birth order to define early and later for causal set events, then the condition of persistence of zero is well defined and could be imposed together with the label invariance or covariance condition to lead, one would hope, to a nice set of dynamical laws. This, at any rate, is the proposal. The question now is whether persistence of zero, defined in the way I just indicated, is on one hand permissive enough to allow for non-trivial quantum measures mu, but at the same time strict enough that the resulting family of measures mu is tractable, and of course what's most important is physically relevant. Thanks.
Question would be, so for you, the fundamental structure is actually the causal set together with this birth order structure, right? So this is not just
the usual causal set,
but it remembers who was born when.
This is a labeled causal set, so it's very tricky. So the fundamental structure is meant to be the unlabeled causal set.
Right.
But in defining dynamics for it, we have recourse to the labels, and then we have to put them in somehow, and then we have to take them out at the end,
so that the only thing
that remains is the naturality of the labeling. In other words, this would not be a valid. They couldn't be born in this way, right?
Okay. So the second part of the question is. Because there are more than one labeling to the causal set, which is natural, I imagine, the relevant things which are physical somehow should be independent of that labeling.
Which were you referring to?
You might have different labelings for the same fundamental causal
Absolutely.
Set, right? So the physical information should be independent.
Should be independent.
Has that been shown?
We don't yet have in the classical sequential growth. Yes.
That's what we call
discrete general covariance.
Yeah. Right.
And that's the key condition for deriving the transition probabilities that define classical sequential growth. Of course, we haven't defined any quantum sequential growth yet.
Okay, but
all I said is that we certainly want the same thing.
Okay.
We would expect that we need the same thing to be true.
What did you have in mind when you mentioned non-trivial examples at the last slide?
Non-trivial
quantum mechanics.
What did I mean by trivial? You mean?
No, you said non-trivial.
Well, non-trivial would be something interesting. So, trivial would be, for example, I mean, we're not that hard up, so it's not going to happen. But a very trivial case would be the only solution of this persistent zero condition and general covariance or label invariance was mu equals zero identically. All events to have measure zero. That'll certainly satisfy if we leave out a normalization condition, that mu of omega should be one. That'll satisfy it, but it wouldn't lead to anything interesting. More generally, another thing that will satisfy it is it was a purely classical theory, because then there's no interference, and you'll have no events of measure zero unless all the histories associated with that essentially have measure zero, and they'll just drop out of the story. So any classical Markov model or probability distribution on the causal sets would be another solution. I'm regarding that also as trivial. That's a good question. And then, those are two examples.
So by non-trivial, you didn't have in mind any paradoxes?
Oh, no, not yet.
Okay.
Just one question, which is in this construction, because you're thinking of later events and earlier events, you could just use the fact that the event A is in, for example, if you had a stem set, and I'm going to be a bit technical, but if you had a stem set, then you could also say that the event B, this chain, for example, is in the future, because that's intrinsic, that's label invariant. And if you said that, then this is truly in the future of the of these two elements. So you could do it in a way that is label invariant.
Well, if you have an idea that we very much need to talk immediately after after Yasaman's talk or whenever we have. But yes, but at the moment, I think there's something. Well,
right.
I think there's an obstruction, but let's discuss it. Even Bell causality didn't have a label invariant formulation in the classical stochastic case.
Are there any more questions? Yes, just one last question quickly because we're kind of running a little late.
So in the abstract, you say POZ persistence of zero tries to capture the elusive idea that no cause can act outside its future length. No?
Right.
How does POZ relate to this idea?
Well, as I said, that's a much longer story. Let me just say, let me repeat what I said and then say what I was referring to in that vague allusion that I made, if I can even find it. Somewhere I said, why did you? Anyway, I can't find it right now, but oh, here it is. Why is it a causality condition at all? So you see, if in ordinary, the most naive sense of causality, it means that something that happens earlier can affect something that might happen later, but something that happens later cannot affect something that might happen earlier. So that means if you condition on the earlier event, the probabilities of later events will change. But of course, it's also true. Now I'm saying something false, but let me say it. If you condition on the later event, the probabilities of the early events will not change. That's not actually true. But in this case, something is true, which is that if I condition on an earlier event, the vanishing or non-vanishing of the later event will change in general. But if I condition on the later event, the vanishing of the earlier event will not change. So there you have an example where the past is affecting the future. The future is not affecting the past. The longer answer has to do with the Bell inequalities and the, more precisely the Tsirosin inequalities. Persistence of zero turns out to be what you need to get what's called a joint quantum measure. I'm just throwing out words, but if you assume persistence of zero, you can derive the so-called Tsirosin inequalities, which are the precise counterpart in quantum mechanics of the Bell inequalities in classical mechanics. The Bell inequalities, I think everyone recognized, reflect some sort of causality condition, which he called very perceptively local causality. And this persistence of zero, therefore, incorporates some idea which is related to what I called separable causality. Let me leave it there.
Okay. We have no time for more questions, so let's please thank the speaker.